there, and welcome to this, the 219th episode of Radio Free Nintendo. This is Greg sitting in as host for Johnny tonight, who is assuredly doing more productive things with his time than recording the 219th episode of this podcast.
It's almost a milestone.
Always willing to waste his time with us, and indeed his money, on collector's editions of games, is Mr. John Lindemann.
Hello all, pleasure to be
that
here.
That he will never play.
You're not going to do the song? I thought it was going to be every week now. Hide your kids, hide your wife.
I'd much rather you do it every episode now.
that's all you're getting out of me.
The thing is, I threw the bait out there, and I got exactly the response I wanted, so you've been caught in my trap, Mr. Leahy.
And returning to us after a rare week off, the Sultan of Surliness himself, James Jones.
I'm not sure I appreciate alliteration at this hour.
We are starting a little bit later than usual with recording, because joining us from the West Coast, filling in for Johnny this week, is our man, the host of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, Michael TYP Cole.
I'm not half the engineer Johnny is, but hello everyone. Good to be back.
Are you half the talker that he is? We might need at least that.
I might be half the talker, maybe. We'll
it's tough. I can say when editing new business that sometimes the three of us are not half the talker that Johnny is. Yeah. This week, in fact, the three of us, myself, John and James, don't have very much to say for ourselves in new business, though we've been busy with other things. And so we decided to shift the composition a bit of the show. And so we have TYP with us, who had the opportunity to go and play a bit of Disney Epic Mickey. And that's the last time I'm going to give it its full name, Disney Epic Mickey. it's Epic Mickey from here on.
Yes, I agree.
So he's going to share his impressions of that, along with anything else that he's managed to fit in the past few weeks since we last had him on the show. And then we're going to go pretty much straight on to listener mail from there. I've mined the backlog of many really good questions that were posed to us, but unfortunately we hadn't got to yet. So we've got a big bumper batch of listener mail to catch up. We still inevitably aren't going to get to everyone's questions, but don't dismay. Just keep them coming, RFN at Nintendo World Report, and we always enjoy responding to your feedback. So with that, we're going to commence on new business. And TYP, you had the opportunity to actually go out to Disneyland itself.
Yes, I was basically asked on like 2 days' notice, hey, do you want to go to Disneyland to cover Epic Mickey? I'm like,
that sounds about right.
Yeah, okay. You know, I'm no stranger to Disneyland. I live about an hour away from Disneyland, and I had a season pass a few years ago, so I'm no stranger. But it was certainly a treat to take a little bit of time off work and go on an adventure instead of a daily grind. So it was a lot of fun, and they treated us real well. But you know, the reason we went was to cover Epic Mickey, and I got about 2.5-3 hours of time with it, and it was pretty cool because they had a huge number of kiosks, and so basically I just sat down in front of one of many TVs, and one of the producers just sat with me the whole time while I played it and sort of walked me through everything they were showing.
Right. They felt the need to take you through. Was there anything they were kind of explaining that you felt like needed to be explained by an outside party? Or
well, it was a demo. It wasn't the full game. I guess they had certain things that they were showing and things they weren't, so they were kind of guiding the experience a little bit, and they were using a debug menu to jump through.
That sounds familiar. Sounds exactly like E3.
But they showed some different things from E3. And I played the game during E3. I think I talked about it on the show a little bit.
Yeah.
But I got a more positive impression playing it now.
Did it have checkpoints? That would be a huge improvement.
Well, I didn't die. I did die. And no, there wasn't a checkpoint, but it was near the beginning of the level. So.
Oh, okay.
And it seemed like it was a pretty short area.
I mean, that's the thing. We did obviously cover this Epic Mickey on the E3 podcast. But since then, it's been pretty much absent from our show. In particular, you might remember when we did the fall games preview, where we just kind of threw our most anticipated games, the four of us, into the ring, kind of just off the cuff, really. Epic Mickey was not one of them. So, I mean, is there a reason that you could give people at us who might not be at the top of our radar on the base of your playtime? What is the big thing to get excited about this game?
Well, I went into that being kind of underwhelmed, saying, "Eh, whatever, Epic Mickey." I actually was pretty impressed with the game, and not so much for the gameplay, but the presentation is very, very good, and it really didn't come across at E3, or maybe they just weren't there at E3, but it really does feel like it was crafted with love, and it's very much capturing Disneyland and Mickey very well. So it's excellent use of the franchise. Just having Oswald the Rabbit is very cute, and he actually brings a lot to it. It sounds trivial, but the cutscenes actually are pretty well done, and it's just sort of an interesting plot. So, but equally interesting are some of the random allusions to other Disneyland or Mickey cartoons. So there's some funny stuff like I walked through the first area of Mean Street, which is kind of the hub world, but I only saw the first iteration of it. It changes over the period of the game. There were maybe 6 or 7 versions of it in the menu system, in the debug menu. But you walk around, and there are just funny jokes, like Mickey's observing that there are a lot of characters that look pretty similar. And it's like, oh, yeah, well, they're all like iterative versions of these characters that everyone's forgotten about. So they're like 8 versions of the same cow that's just slightly different, right? So, and they're about another part that's actually a bigger part of the game is there are a lot of different versions of Pete. And so, you know, he says, how could I forget about you? You know, this is a world for lost Disney characters. Why are you still here? You know, and he says, well, there are lots of me. You know, there's Pegleg Pete, there's Small Pete, there's Big Bad Pete, there's whatever. There's, you know, and that's really true. If you look at the archives of this Pete character, there was a lot of variations of him.
Well, it seems like the main thing then that you took away from it is just the kind of the nuanced, kind of intelligent mining of Disney history and minutiae.
Absolutely.
And little behind the scenes stuff. I mean, do you think that's going to limit the game's appeal to people who really are, you know, Disney-philes?
It might. I mean, they'll get a lot more out of it. I think if you've been to Disneyland a couple of times or Disney World and you've been on some of the rides that they're kind of spoofing or incorporating and riffing on, I think you'll appreciate a lot more. And same thing with like the old Mickey cartoons that it captures and these funny jokes like Horace Horsecollar who's oh, I was a celebrity, I was in these 3 Mickey cartoons, don't you remember me? But the gameplay is serviceable. It's not a bad game. It's just hard to tell from my limited time with it how much meat there is to the whole exploration. I mean, there's a lot of little nooks and crannies to explore from what I saw, but largely your reward are pins, which are, again, like Disney collectible type things. But I think they're tied into artwork, so you unlock artwork. But once again, if you're not a Disney fan, that's going to be of limited interest to you. But really, I think largely they are targeting people who maybe aren't hardcore gamers, but they really enjoy Disney franchises, and this game really is like a Disney product. It's not I'd almost see this more as a Disney product than a video game in terms of how they're marketing it and what they're focusing on. And I'm all for that if it means using the franchise well. But the gameplay isn't bad. Like I said, there's some pretty funny stuff. I mean, the platforming's serviceable and exploration's probably going to be the stronger suit. But one aspect that I thought was pretty interesting was the boss battle I played, right, which was with a robotic Captain Hook. I guess the concept is that Oswald or someone else in this world is crafted makeshift versions of Mickey's friends because they're envious of Mickey and his popular life. So there's a robotic Goofy and robotic Donald Duck and apparently robotic Captain Hook as well. And so you can fight him 2 ways. One way is to just do an all-out battle with him, which is kind of the obvious approach when you first start the boss battle. But if you paint in the staircase that he kind of destroys during the intro cutscene, you can go up a second way, which is more platforming, painting in platforms and then jumping and whatever, getting rid of weights that are holding down the sails of the ship. And so you get to the top and then you save whatever the character is that you're saving. And that was interesting. If there's a lot of that, that could be interesting and allow for replayability.
Well, that seems to be what Warren Spector in his interviews has been trying to play up the most, this whole thing of play style matters. We've got you can either sort of create with paint or you can destroy with thinner, and there's going to be all these different ways to do things. That's a pretty good substantive example, I guess. I mean, it must be difficult to kind of plot out how well that projects out over. It's supposed to be, I think he said it's like a 25-hour game or something.
This is what he said in his presentation, was that when he played the game, it took him 25 hours. However, this is Warren Spector talking. He's going to look at every nook and cranny because he loves Disneyland and he loves his game.
And he needs to make sure it's not broken.
Well, no, I mean,
exactly. So he's a lot like me, though. You know, I mean, you know, I take my time with games. And
no, he didn't say 25 years.
But I appreciate. I'm a connoisseur. I appreciate it. You know,
John, this game is coming out November 30th, not next decade.
Oh, well, I'm telling you, I'm looking at this game and I'm thinking 75 hours, easy.
75
no.
months.
No, but just watching Warren as he walked through the park with us afterwards, we'll get to that later, but he clearly really cares a lot about Disneyland and Disney franchises and all that stuff. And so he would definitely get a kick out of exploring his own game that his team worked on and saying, sure. Oh, I know that street in Disneyland. I know that street. And just sort of basking in the glory of the game. And I think a lot of hardcore Disney fans will do that. I think that's a legitimate way to enjoy this game, because there's going to be a lot of stuff like, oh yeah, this is taken from, you know, Small World. This is a reference to, you know, some scene in a Disney movie. Like, there's a cut scene where Pete Pan, not Peter Pan, but going back to the previous discussion, Pete Pan is fighting robotic Captain Hook. And I could have sworn, like, halfway through watching this cutscene, like, you know, the swordplay looks awfully familiar, and I'm pretty sure it's actually taken a recreation of a scene from the movie.
Right.
So there's move a lot of move. Stuff like that that really sharp Disney files will catch and really appreciate. So I think that there's a lot of love for Disney fans. I got a real kick out of perhaps the most interesting area I saw, which was Mickey Junk Mountain. And the whole concept of this is that this is where Oswald lives. It's kind of the top of the world. And it's a mountain made up of old abandoned Mickey merchandising. So old Mickey phones and calendars and lunch boxes and all this stuff that clearly actual things that existed that they took from the archives. And then there's one point where you have to dislodge some junk to create platforms. And it turns out they're old SNES and NES cartridges. Mm-hmm. And at first I couldn't figure out what game it was, and then I saw one that was Mickey Mousecapade, which I own, so it's like, oh god, that's great.
That's pretty awesome.
Well, that's good, but it's not a giant pile of grab by the ghoulies, is it?
Yeah.
Let's be honest.
I'm sorry.
No. It's not even a pile, a trash can. A trash can full of them.
Yeah. So I do think that they put a lot of thought into the game, and it seems like a really good product. Whether it's a super good platformer, I'm not so sure, but I mean, there's some people who play games purely for the gameplay, and then there are other people that play for other reasons as well, like atmosphere and humor or whatever.
Well, I mean, I know he's described it as kind of a mix of platforming and something closer to a Zelda game, you know, in terms of the kind of puzzle solving and action adventure-y kind of stuff. So I'm not sure how strong the platform is going to be. And indeed, it sounds like you can almost choose how strong you want the platforming to be, because sometimes doing something with the paint will lead you to solve something by platforming, whereas in other cases you wouldn't. But the one thing I was a little unclear about, just reading interview, I watched his interview with Neil from a bit ago, for instance, is that he says that on the one hand, like, characters will respond to you differently based on your kind of preferences, how you approach problems, whether you destroy stuff or create stuff. Uh-huh. But on the other hand, it's a linear story. Like, there's not really a branching story.
Right. It doesn't affect the plot.
I think it would be more along the lines of whether characters are friendly to you during interactions in the hub world or not. I think that's what it would amount to.
It does sound kind of trivial.
Yeah. Right. And even the upgrade system is very trivial. I mean, I asked the producer, hey, you know, do you gain extra powers over the course of this game to you know, advance the gaming? And he's like, well, you know, you can, depending on whether you're using more paint thinner or paint to, you know, solve your puzzles, it will lead you down paths that'll cause you to get upgrades for either your paint or your paint thinner in terms of being able to store more ink. But that doesn't seem like that big a deal to me. Basically, I'm not hearing, oh yeah, you get this awesome power halfway through the game that changes how you play it. That's not happening.
I mean, I suppose, you know, if you've got a lot of case-by-case instances where there are these quite radical differences depending on which way you take, like you explained with the boss battle, it could sustain it, you know, over quite a while.
Yeah.
And then there's this whole thing about play through it multiple times to get everything. I mean, again, that sounds like something that would have branching kind of in its structure, but it really doesn't.
It has to do with what collectibles you can find, basically.
Right.
Yeah, and maybe there's certain missions you can only get if you've done certain things beforehand. But once again, it comes down to these collectibles. I don't know how much gameplay will change from one to the other in that perspective. So I'm more concerned about during a single playthrough some of the gameplay getting a little old. But I saw so little of the game, it's hard to tell whether they flesh out the puzzle aspects of this painting and erasing, because it has potential for, you know, what I saw was largely glorified lock and key or glorified key. But I could see potential there.
No, it's a cool idea. There's no doubt about it. Yeah. Whether it's, as you said, whether it's going to sustain a whole game is a little questionable. But what about the 2D stuff? Did you see any more of that? I mean, we've been kind of led to believe that they're just kind of transitions between levels and nothing, you know, particularly major.
They only showed me one, and it was what looked to me looked like the first one, because it was right after the tutorial section and we didn't jump around. And so it was really simplistic. It was kind of a vertical oriented platformer, based on, I guess, Mickey and the Beanstalk or Jack and the Beanstalk, whatever the cartoon is called. and it was easy. It was simple. But they seem to be shying away from showing any of the later stuff, so it's not clear.
And the cutscenes are kind of handled with that curious kind of visual style. What did you think of that?
I like it. I think that's where a lot of the humor is. But there, some of them are real-time cutscenes too, and they also are pretty well animated. So there's a bit of both. I think they're both very well done. I think the kind of almost jigsaw puzzle style cutscenes added a quirky humor to the whole presentation that really fits with this sort of bizarre world you're in, that's just sort of like Disneyland, but not quite. And furthermore, like, Mickey knows who Walt Disney is in this game, or at least he seems to. So it's kind of this weird aspect of, like, this is cartoons, Roger Rabbit style, where cartoons are in the real world, is kind of undertones too of those.
Self-aware.
Yeah, self-aware. It's like, yeah, I was famous. I was in this cartoon, you know?
Yeah. Well, being that you are, of course, the host of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, I couldn't not ask you about the music. Did you get to hear it at all?
It was too hard to hear. I mean, they had it pretty low. There were a lot of people playing, so if you heard it, it would be with a lot of other people. In that sense, it was a little more like E3. So I really can't comment on the music. Some of the voice acting is pretty limited to the Wizard. Which is Disney backwards. I can't pronounce it. And everything else is kind of barks. You know, I'm surprised they don't have voice acting. Like, Mickey and his friends are all Banjo-Kazooie style. But I couldn't
well
hear.
Well done.
Apparently, the composer, someone quite famous, he did music for the TV show Pushing Daisies. He's won awards and stuff, you know. So, I mean, they have made the effort. Now, TYP, you did have, of course, this was a rare opportunity, I guess, to get a bit of the VIP treatment at Disneyland. So, you may as well share some of your experiences there, because it's blogged about on the website, of course. Yeah. But it'd be cool for you to share it with the listeners.
Yeah. So after we spent 2.5 hours or so talking about and playing the game, and grabbing a little bit of catered lunch, we walked over. Warren and a more regular Disney tour guide walked us around the park a bit. And our first stop was in front of the fire station, which I really hadn't given much of a thought to. But it turns out the second floor of the fire station on Main Street is where Disney's apartment was, Walt Disney's apartment was. So that's where he would go to escape from the park, or while they were building a new attraction, you know, if he wanted to take a break and whatever, peace and quiet, that's where he would go. And so they've preserved it pristinely, basically, the way he had it when he lived and was working there. So it's sort of a rare opportunity that VIPs get to go backstage. I wasn't allowed to take any photos.
No.
But they took us up in groups of maybe 10, 15 people. And you go up there, and it's interesting because they got old family photos, and they have like an old gramophone, and Walt has his, what was it? It was like a kitchenette, and there was like a grilled cheese maker. Apparently he was famous for eating his grilled cheese sandwiches. And so after that, we all moseyed on over to Pirates of the Caribbean, where we cut in line and rode
that. Oh, I see.
And then we walked over to the Haunted Mansion, where, you know, the idea, I think, with this tour was for people who maybe hadn't been to Disneyland or Disney World to get a little perspective. They're hoping, you know, if you see a little bit of what they're referencing in the game, you'll have a better appreciation for it, I think.
So I imagine they're going to have, you know, free tickets to Disneyland in every copy of Epic Mickey.
For the
customer. Yeah, that's happening. Yeah.
With sort of just the word context emblazoned on them.
Yeah, well, it was smart of them to do this. And then finally you walked over and did Space Mountain. Once again, cutting a line. Now, keep in mind, this was a Thursday early afternoon. So it was actually pretty open. So even though we were cutting in line, we actually weren't cutting that
you
many
weren't
people.
Literally destroying children's dreams.
Yeah.
Sorry, kids, you don't get to ride Space Mountain.
And by the way, there is no Santa Claus. Move along.
I've spoken like a man that said that before.
Never. Only internally.
So the fun of the funny things is we have Warren Spector, you know, leading a group of 30, 40 people with cameras, and everyone's wearing little Epic Mickey, you know, event badges, and you're walking by and you're like, oh, what's Epic Mickey? What's Epic Mickey? And it's really funny to hear them saying that. And then, you know, later on, there's some people like saying, oh, is that Steven Spielberg? Is that
the beard and the glasses?
Yeah, well, he has his hat on. It's just, you know, unless you get really close, like, that's what, he does look kind of like him. And Craig Harris from IGN was sort of laughing and chuckling about it. He predicted it, and then like a minute later, someone walked by. I was like, is that Steven Spielberg? So that was fun times. But for me, the highlight of the whole thing was over dinner, where they had two Disney animators. And I got pretty friendly with one of them. She's a really friendly person. She was probably in her, I don't know, her 60s. She'd been around for a long time doing this, and it was very clear. She was just talking while she was drawing, and you would request a character. And then she would say, well, why do you like the character? What is it, you know? So everyone was talking about their childhood memories of what TV shows they used to watch or what movies they liked. And she would just talk on and on, just constantly talking, giving weird factoids about, oh, yeah, the voice actor was such and such and all these other weird. She knew everything. I think she had a photographic memory because she was a very good artist.
Well, I suppose it helps with recreating characters on demand.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
People were asking for Mickey or whatever. Eventually, people were like, well, can you do Uncle Scrooge? And then we had like three Uncle Scrooges drawn because, of course, DuckTales and things like that. It's the right, you know.
Well, he should have gone off the Disney reservation altogether and asked for like Duckman.
So that was really impressive. I watched her for about an hour just drawing. If you've heard about how like Michelangelo used to say that he would take a slab of marble and the figure would already be in there, he would just bring it out. It sort of felt like that watching her work, because she'd been doing this for so long, and her, you know, her strokes were so elegant and effortless that it just sort of, all of a sudden, there it is. There, oh my God. You know, it's like it just sort of appears out of nowhere.
When they were actually set up at E3 doing animations for people, like cartoon versions of the people who were there. Mm-hmm. There was some ridiculous line for that. And I remember having the same impression, just watching them just burn through these drawings. And
yeah,
they would have somebody's face in about 2 minutes. And you'd just be like, how did they do that?
Yeah, it was amazing. Then we were walked over to where what's usually the Muppets theme park thing, which is in 3D. But they tweaked it so that it's instead preview of Tron, which I gotta say, not interested at all in that movie.
Not a big Tron guy.
No. I wasn't a big Tron guy in general, and it just what they saw, which was like they showed maybe like 5 or 10 minutes from the movie, right when he first enters the whatever the computer, the Matrix, whatever. And
the glowy space, yes.
It does have a giant face as an antagonist, so it's kinda like Star Fox.
Do a barrel roll.
Any excuse.
I don't know. It just seemed like it was all pizzazz and no substance, you know, just like, well, why is they doing this? Like they had a scene where he's been designed to be in the games. And so he goes into this empty room, and then like there are four corners, and a hot woman comes from each corner to put on like one piece of his equipment. And then they walk backwards and go back into the wall. It's like, why?
Wish fulfillment.
That sounds about right. Did they take their time putting this stuff on, or was it just instantly on?
It was instantly on. It just sort of locks and like merges with his outfit or whatever.
Oh,
there's no lotion applied to make sure it comes.
Put that
to
on
body.
Real slow. Oh yeah.
Gotta put this on nice and gentle.
Well, that sounds like a perfectly wholesome adventure.
Actually, you're cutting me off early. After this horrible movie that I had to watch a little bit of, they walked us to. I don't know if it's a temporary thing or what, but they had an arcade that was themed after the arcade from the movie, where they had a bunch of old arcade games.
That's right. This is in the blog as well.
It's in the blog as well. So, of course, so I walked around. They have all sorts of old Atari games and track and field, which I didn't even know there was I'd only seen the NES game, which I owned. And then they had a version of Punch-Out that I got to play a little bit of. And Chris Kohler's
wireframes.
Yeah, with the wireframes and Donkey Kong. And I was reminded how bad I am at arcade games, even that are old. I was never an arcade game guy, so
they're hard.
Sucked ass.
Really hard.
I just sucked ass. I mean, it's
give
like Donkey
quarters
Kong. Oh, I know how to play.
Me.
I know how to play Donkey Kong. This will be fun. Like, oh crap.
Why is he throwing 12 barrels a second? What's going on?
Was Punch-Out the one with two screens?
Yeah, it had two screens. It has a screen at the top that shows your stats.
It's It's a weird piece of kit to see in person.
Yeah, it is.
Well, that's all for your adventure out in Disneyland now. But you have, to my personal chagrin, because Kirby's Epic Yarn still hasn't shown up. And
dude, I'm so done with that game. I probably finished most of that in like 2 weeks ago.
Greg's copy is coming by sale, apparently.
I think it's not coming at all.
You got to paint in the sails, Greg, or else it won't move. Just like Captain Hook's ship.
I don't think any amount of paintbrushing
is coming as part of the new triangle trade.
So I guess I could talk about Epic Yarn a little bit. No one else
has
this?
Well, I know. I'm intrigued to get your thoughts because I know you're a big proponent of Wario Land Shake It, Goodfield's previous game, and of the Kirby games that aren't Squeak Squad as well. I quite enjoy some of those. So having apparently played it to your satisfaction, I will play Kirby's Epic Yarn eventually by hook or by crook. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts on it.
I think it's very fun. It's very well done. It's laid back, but also kind of interesting, both visually and in terms of gameplay. And I think definitely as a two-player game, it would be a lot of fun to just sort of casually go through. I played a few levels with my girlfriend, and they were fun. I mean, it was hard to coordinate, kind of like New Super Mario Brothers. But it's shorter than I thought it would be. In terms of unlockables and stuff, I mean, if you're interested in getting all the textures and textiles for your house, then I guess maybe there's more to do.
So, what are they? Are they connected to challenges similar to the kind of missions in Shake It?
There are some challenges like that. I haven't done too much of that. There's some stuff where you talk to your neighbors in town, and they have these missions where it's like, oh, find five of my friends within 2 minutes, or things like that in the levels. And of course there are the beads to collect for high scores. But there isn't the mission based thing that was in Wario Land, where there was a lot of unique stuff in each level in that sense. At least I haven't seen it yet.
Right. So it's more like you have a few general types of these sorts of things that you do on different levels.
Yeah. So I think Wario Land Shake It's the better game, especially if you're going for like hardcore gameplay. But Kirby is definitely a very good game, and it kind of reminds me of Yoshi's Island in a couple of ways. I mean, Yoshi's Island is a much harder game and probably has more variety. But the transformations in Epic Yarn really give off a Yoshi's Island vibe. I mean, there are even some that just like, there's the mole transformation where you're digging through clouds that are made out of what appears to be cotton balls.
Yeah.
But it definitely feels like, the mole transformation out of Yoshi's Island. And then there are a couple other points where I'm like, oh yeah, this is pretty cool. So I think if you're going for 100% all the treasures, some levels have some interesting stuff.
Secret levels? I mean, is there a comparable kind of jump in complexity? Obviously kind of starting from a lower base in the Epic Yarn,
I wouldn't say
to
so,
shake it.
But I think some of the secret levels are just kind of silly fun. I mean, most of the primary levels are more straightforward platformers that might have a transformation near the end. Most of the secret levels are that you have to unlock by getting above a certain number of gems in the boss battles. Most of those are reprises of early transformations.
Right.
Only they're pretty much the whole level. And so they might make greater use of the transformation, or they might just be a lot of fun because of the nature of the transformation and the move. Like Johnny mentioned this one too last week. There's a penguin on a surfboard transformation that is a lot of fun. That, once again, like Yoshi's Island, it reminded me of those sequences where you're skiing downhill, where you're just going.
Yeah.
Those are really fun.
I bet you haven't got K-Met coming after you though all the time, have you?
You don't, but there are one or two points where there was that kind of phenomenon going on. I'm trying to remember
that secret level. I think it was the secret level of the fifth world in Yoshi's Island where K-Mix coming at that.
I love that
really
level. That's
hard.
Really brutal. There's nothing brutal like that.
No, I certainly wouldn't have expected.
But
so,
another fun transformation you see a couple of times is a starship. There are two of them. One's side scrolling and one's vertical. So there are a couple of vertical shooters, basically, or side scrolling shooters that are pretty casual, but going back to, I think, the Wario Land Shake It interview, they said how they wanted to make a shooting game. So they may have squeezed that into Kirby.
Yeah, well, I mean, they did the submarine stages in
Shake
It. There was a couple of those. That was very slow-paced.
Yeah, I didn't like those. I don't think there's anything that boring or slow-paced in the Kirby game. I think it's much better paced than the submarine levels. But one thing Johnny hadn't gotten here yet, but the entire game, the soundtrack, you know, is pretty much entirely new compositions. They're very laid back, jazzy, a lot of piano. I like it. I'm not sure I like it as much as Johnny, just because it kind of blends together after a while. Mm. But what happens is there's maybe one transformation that has a Kirby song, but basically you don't hear any Kirby music during gameplay until you get to the... It's a spoiler. I'm sorry. If it spoilers, everyone.
No!
I could. You know I haven't played it. I mean, that's just cruel.
I'm sorry.
Now Greg's going to cry.
Should I stop talking now?
No. Okay.
Might as well ruin the whole game.
Yeah, no.
And the last boss, he's made of textiles. So
no, I'm not going to go there. But there are certain things. I'll put it this way. There are certain things that you didn't realize you missed that are usually hallmarks of Kirby games that all of a sudden you see again in the music you hear again. And you're like, oh yeah, this is a Kirby game. And it's just sort of an interesting phenomenon where like most Kirby games have really rehashed the music a lot.
So they're just kind of saving up what you normally get spread out through a Kirby game.
Yeah, and a lot of it's kind of trivial stuff, but you appreciate it.
You appreciate more because they made you wait.
Yeah.
Well, I continue to look forward to it, but I did want to ask you, now that you've had two good feel games behind you, what would you like to see them do next? Obviously, I want them to do Yoshi.
I think Yoshi would be good. I've said it before, but if they're interested in doing a 3D game, I think that they would be a good team to do a Star Fox game. And if they really are interested in doing a shooter, it might be a good match.
Mm, yeah, so that's a cool little out of the box suggestion. I'd be open to anybody doing a Star Fox game at this point. I can't put that with the possible
Namco?
Exception.
Are you sure?
You preempted the judge.
Now Assault is a good game, apparently.
It's a good multiplayer game. We're told
it's a good half of a game.
I've never played any of Assault actually. I have been tempted just because I'm such a big Star Fox fan, kind of just to know about it.
I probably bought it.
If Goodfeel is tasked or interested in making another 2D game, then yeah, I think a Yoshi's Island game would be fantastic.
I could see a Goodfeel Yoshi kind of bisecting Wario and Kirby.
It may not be different enough. They may get bored doing that.
Yeah, see, that's what I was thinking, is that if they did that, which would be the natural thing, you know, Yoshi, it's kind of more cute like Kirby, but you're probably gameplay wise, you know, a bit more intricate, you know, maybe a bit more twitchy Wario. But you have to bisect two games you've just made back to back. Could be, you know, maybe they'll do something else first and come back to it on a subsequent console.
If they're not interested in working anymore with Team Ninja and Goodfeel's interested in making a less level-based game, I think Metroid might be a good pick for him.
Yeah,
too.
Well, I've said some of that stuff in Wario, the environmental puzzle stuff, you know, if you chop that up and structured it differently, that could fit into a Metroid-type scenario. And I would love to see a 2D Metroid game, you know, literally 2D, unlike, you know, some of the sort of pseudo-2D bits in Other M, with really beautiful 2D artwork. Mm-hmm. Well, so we're now going to finish off new business, unless anyone has anything impromptu.
I have something impromptu. So after I sent...
Fasten your seatbelts.
Strap yourself in, folks.
You're asking for it, John. After I sent my notice that, man, I haven't played anything, I then proceeded to play something, because that's how I roll. So basically, I went on the Live Arcade because I haven't been there in a while and just sort of poked around. First off, I'm shocked by how many games they have available for on-demand games, I think is what they call it. I think they're up to like 55, 60, 360 games on demand, which is, I mean, like full games, not like downloadable titles. Mm-hmm. But after realizing the prices for those games were awful when compared to the secondhand market for those same games with a physical copy. I mean, we're like $6-7 more expensive. I'm like, yeah, no, we're not doing that.
Oh, yeah, that's just pretty... It's like John talked about God of War collection stuff going up on PSN last week. I mean, you can get the physical disc cheaper than downloading both of those games.
Yep. Yeah, it's stupid. So that didn't fly. So I basically went around and sorted the list of Xbox arcade games basically by their rating, and came across a game around, say, 10:30 last night called Toy Soldiers, which I remember getting good reviews. So I downloaded the enormous demo, which is the whole game, which is still enormous.
Yeah, try a long lot.
It's like 700 megabytes for a tower defense game. It's got some size to it. And began to play it thinking, man, this is all right, but I'm not having that much fun, before realizing that it had crossed into midnight and then beyond that. And that we were now about 3 hours into being, quote, not having much fun.
But this is normal for you playing these B-grade RPGs, right?
But, well, no, I'm usually at least aware of the time that's passing with those games. Like, this game, I'm like, eh, this really isn't all that great.
Well, were you drunk, though?
No, I wasn't drunk, John.
It's a legitimate question.
Some of us have to go to work respectably.
Just really tired.
Yes.
having played games they thought weren't very good for hours on end.
Caffeine takes care of that. So basically what this game is, it's a tower defense game, which I've spoken on the show in the past, that generally speaking, that genre is dead to me. Because
played
it's been,
out.
Yeah, I mean, it was played out when it was Stolen Flash games. When people started charging $12 for them, I was hailing a cab to get the hell out of there.
Yeah, I'm with you, James. I've never seen the appeal of these games, personally.
This game is a little bit different. First off, it's a tower defense game where you have to pick the type of weaponry you want, be it like some type of anti-personnel machine gun, long-range cannons, gas deployment devices. But then you can also take control over any of them and operate them for the battle, to try to sort of counteract the waves of forces that are coming at you. And there's essentially a campaign mode of something like 20 different battlefields that you have to get through. And as the game gets further in, it opens up more stuff. But there's also vehicles you can control, like aircraft and tanks. So, to my knowledge, it's a pretty short list of games set during World War I. This game is kind of World War I-ish, but it's toy soldiers. But they're like mechanical soldiers, so when you blow them up, the little pieces of shrapnel come out, and all the weapons are made of, you know, like, wind-up toys. I guess there's a little bit of social commentary on the nature of that particular war. But it's actually kind of a fun title. I went back to it later and realized, you know, this is kind of fun. It's mostly mindless. There's not much waiting around like there is in all the other tower defense titles. Because, you know, you can go get in your Whippet tank and then roll around at 4 miles an hour and try to take out their towers, or just interrupt the flow of their waves of forces by just getting in front of where they're going to spawn and blowing them up.
Tonka tough.
So, James, would you categorize this as a victory for the feature of having the games being rated and thus ordered by rating?
Yeah, definitely. Because, I mean, there's hundreds of games on this service, and I'm sure the majority of them are garbage. I mean, if it's like Nintendo's download services, where we had a quote, game this week that was the screens blink different colors, then yes, I'm sure it's...
I mean, I think they not long ago brought it. It was this year that they brought that feature to PSN. But, you know, I mean, with WiiWare, I think the only way it kind of works is that, you know, whatever's on the most selling list kind of functions as that. So the rich get richer, which is probably why we always, you know, well, one of multiple reasons why Super Mario Bros. 3, you know, continues to dominate as it does.
Yeah, that and it's Super Mario Brothers 3.
Yeah, and all the usual suspects. And so, I believe they've said they're going to do ratings for the 3DS shop.
You have to do it. I mean...
And demos and stuff, so, I mean, they're learning their lesson.
On the inverse, I'm tempted to go rate by number and then go to, like, the very last page. So you can go download the demo of this Dreckish title. I just go see what you're dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, if it's a total train wreck, that's going to be apparent in the demos. You can have your shits and giggles that way.
Well, I mean, if it's a train wreck, yeah. If it's a total train wreck, and it's cheap, I may end up buying it because it's so awful. Because there's a certain point where a game is so bad, it ceases to be not fun anymore, and it's now just amusing at how inept the game was built. And maybe there's a cheap title like 300 points or something because Microsoft's stupid point structure where I'll never spend all of my points because you can't. So I'll have 40 points dangling around forever. But maybe there's something out there that is worth 200 points that I've got just sitting around because it's so awful. I don't know. But I know that $2 worth of games buys you blinking lights on the DSi, so it can't be worse investment than that.
Fair enough. Well, thanks for the late audible on your business there, James. But we are now going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to get to that promised mountain of listener mail. So join us for that.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Okay, in our blog section, we have Epic Mickey Disneyland Tour. Disney Interactive, as TYP has said, has elaborated on.
We just discussed.
Disney Interactive recently held an event at Disneyland to promote Epic Mickey, and TYP was there to grab photos. You too can experience the swank life of a video game journalist. More Inspector pictures included.
All right, so is the sequel to the underappreciated DJ Hero better than the original? Neil lets us know if new features like Empire Mode should have you returning to scratch once more. What are we scratching now, John?
Don't ask.
We also have some impressions following up on a review he wrote earlier. Zach has written about GoldenEye for the Wii, following up with his multiplayer impressions. So we'll check both his write-ups out because they're both very good.
The inescapable Zach Miller has yet another review, this time for PokéPark Wii, which is another Pokémon spinoff. You can go ahead and find out whether or not he likes it if you go read his review.
Does he have dinosaurs? Are there dinosaurs
well,
there
are dinosaur Pokémon. So
almost, okay.
We also have a new episode of Radio Trivia from somebody who I think is here.
Well, we also got Pedro on.
And this one is a, quote, deranged episode.
Listen to the end for the foul-mouth rant. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to do it for No Play this week, so be sure to check this and all the other original content out at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, and before we commence our listener mail segment, I did want to have what is probably long overdue errata segment, despite the fact that there is only one mistake that I'm going to
In the history of the podcast,
here.
There's only one.
Yeah, well, some people might find it hard to believe that we do make mistakes sometimes. You've heard them, trust me. But you don't hear all of them, actually. I do remove quite a lot of the more blatantly, factually inaccurate things that are said, if I can do so without making the show sound bizarre. But in this case, unfortunately, it got past me, and so I have to apologise for that. You know, I blame Johnny for this, because, you know, if John had said something...
It would immediately have been fact-checked.
He would probably sound like he's straining to remember it or whatever, so I would have checked it out. And if James had said, I'm just suspicious of everything that comes out of James' mouth, it's usually sarcastic or hyperbole or whatever. But Johnny, with great confidence last week, just, you know, so he speaks with such authority. You know, he's a very knowledgeable chap, so... When he said that there is not a Need for Speed on Wii this year, it just, yeah, I took it as correct.
Gospel, I think, would be the word.
I could have stopped this from happening. I've played it. I could have prevented this disaster.
You see the coincidence of factors.
I take one week off and you guys blow it.
Yeah,
that's
tough.
That's why you can never leave, James.
Okay, well, I have an addendum to this errata now that I know we're doing this segment. So Johnny made the assertion that he kicked everyone's ass in GoldenEye when he was playing on the giant GoldenEye screen. but my recollection is that I actually beat everyone, not him. But we both did very well.
TYP, this is a slippery slope. You are pulling apart the entire show now.
Them's challenge
I
words.
I suck at first-person shooters. GoldenEye was like the last one I played. But the people we were playing with just didn't know what they were doing.
The problem is now... Can we believe anything that Johnny says?
I think Johnny was... Were there children involved in GoldenEye? Were there... I mean, was he playing like five-year-olds and stuff?
No. They were our age, but they were just very casual. I mean, I remembered the levels. Johnny remembered the levels. They didn't. So we had an advantage. I mean,
were these people that Johnny selected off the street and kind of brought in and asked them maybe, have you ever played GoldenEye? Do you know what video games are?
But did he throw his controller down after believing that he beat people, even perhaps when he didn't?
He stormed off. He just ripped it out of the system and stormed off.
Anyway, to get back to the more serious correction.
Then he walked out as a fish tune blared. What?
There is a Need for Speed for Wii coming out this year. It's also Need for Speed Hot Pursuit, like the HD versions. And just to rub it in, It will be coming out in America and Europe just days after this podcast goes out. So it's very real. It's
for
very
the system you don't need to reserve.
On the horizon. the thing is that this is not very well publicised, which is, of course, why the person that posed this question, Danny, in England, probably didn't know about it, and why Johnny didn't know about it. They obviously haven't spoken to James.
Which is probably why I saw it at E3.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so they're taking the Excite Bots
approach. Yeah, I mean, that tells you where James is on the totem pole of E3, apparently.
I got in. I didn't even go to the EA event. I just saw it.
But it seems to be a bit like the Call of Duty Modern Warfare Reflex thing, you know?
Yeah.
Because that they didn't even provide media for that for a long time.
Until after it came out, yeah.
I mean, it was kind of. I think they're doing a similar thing with Black Ops actually this year as well. But at least that's, you know, coming out alongside the same version. But of course, Call of Duty is, you know, the biggest name in gaming right now. So it kind of naturally, just the fact that it isn't getting promotion ends up getting covered. Whereas this Wii version of Hot Pursuit is pretty overlooked. But what we do know about it is that it's been made by a UK developer called Exeunt, who produced a previous Need for Speed game for Wii, Undercover. And it's going to have some pretty substantial differences from the HD versions in that it's going to have, like, weapons and, like, power-ups and...
So it's a kart racer, basically.
But weirdly, it's got real-world locations in the Wii version instead of fictional ones in the...
What?
HD version.
Did they just not get the memo on what this game is?
Little strange, but difficult to comment on it beyond that.
All I know Exeunt for is a bunch of EA DS ports.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, they made a Sims game, a FIFA game, I mean...
I think that's the kind of thing they get tasked with, so I'd... Not sure that's cause for great encouragement on this one, but it does exist. It is coming out soon, and I assume that there will be some coverage.
Oh, no.
Some outlets, if they're good enough to provide review copies.
Oh, dear, I just got an error from Exeunt's webpage. That's not a good sign.
So keep your eye out for some sort of future coverage of that, but indeed, it doesn't seem like it's going to be very similar to the Criterion game.
Or related.
So with that, the errata segment is done, hopefully never to return, but, well, it probably should.
It probably should every week.
But will we? Probably not. So we now move on to listener mail, and TYP, you have the first letter.
Okay, Adolf Vega in Arlington, Texas writes, do you guys think Nintendo should consider adding select third-party Wii and DS games to Club Nintendo? Maybe this kind of gesture would have prevented NBA Jam from going multi-platform.
No.
I agree. this would be an honor for third-party games, with titles like Epic Mickey, GoldenEye 007, and Super Scribblenauts being great candidates. What do you guys think of this idea?
Well, I can say... In Europe, there is an example, like, obviously European Club Nintendo is a bit different in a number of ways, but with the whole Monster Hunter situation, where Capcom remained the publisher, but Nintendo was sort of helping with the distribution.
Right.
You can register Monster Hunter Tri for Stars with the European Club Nintendo. So this has been done in a very specific case where it is still technically a third-party game because Capcom is the publisher, but Nintendo's involved.
Are they the official distributor, or are they just kind of like hands in the pie?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure about that. What I do know is that the same arrangement is apparently going to take place for Ghost Trick next year. So presumably, you'll be able to register that for Club Nintendo Stars as well, which is kind of one more reason to look forward to that coming out at the beginning of next year.
I'm sorry. The basic concept of this itty-bitty incentive being a reason why things will sell better, it just is broken. I'm sorry.
No. I think, but see, here's the advantage, though. If they put it in third-party games, it would cost them $0, because apparently nobody buys third-party games for the Wii, so they're safe.
In terms of just shipping out additional rewards.
That's right. It's not... just more printed copies that will never be redeemed. But would it be nice? Sure. I mean, I could always use more Animal Crossing fans, but it's not really going to affect sales any. I mean, hell, I'll get a game and forget to register it for like a year, and then I'll have 1 year where I don't even get silver membership, and the next year I'm like gold because I'm registering for 2 years worth of games.
Yeah, I can't be bothered to do this stuff. I just don't see anything that's of value. I mean, the only time I remember ever, like, sitting down and registering stuff was when they announced the Master Quest special thing several years ago for GameCube.
Right.
Then I sat down and actually did this and got my free copy because I wanted it.
Right.
But, I mean, Mario pin, yeah, it'd be nice, but you know what? I got to do a survey for each of these? No, thank you.
Those pins are huge, too, by the way.
The survey's kind of irksome. I mean, I will say it's one of these things where I think definitely the quality of the rewards is part of it. I mean,
it's gotten better.
Club Nintendo of Europe has some cool rewards. You know, right now, I'm under 2,000 points shy of the Super NES Classic Controller. I actually have enough to get the Platinum 2-disc version of the Super Mario Galaxy soundtrack, but I'm holding out for the Super Mario Galaxy 2 soundtrack.
Oh, nice. And see, we don't get stuff like that. We get, like, Wii Remote holders.
Yeah. It's all crap.
To be fair, besides buying the Game & Watch collection, the first one, I bought the second one used for, like, $6 because that seemed more economical. I've spent my points on things for other people because there's just nothing for me that I want. I mean, what I always wanted was to be able to exchange points for like Nintendo point cards.
Yeah, they do that in Europe.
Yes.
It's like an exchange rate of 400 stars would equal like 100 Nintendo points.
I would spend all of my points on that.
Yep.
I mean, I do tend to agree that even if you had robust rewards, or like a Nintendo points exchange rate with your stars or coins, is coins in America?
Yes, it's coins.
It's still going to be absolutely some sort of tiny effect that it would have, and then you get into questions of like, well, you know, why do certain third parties get this treatment?
Kickbacks.
Yeah. What would the criteria be? You know, I mean, that's why, you know, with Monster Hunter, it's pretty simple. The criteria is, well, Nintendo is helping publish the game in a way, well, distribute it anyway. So, you know, in that case, that's pretty easy to see.
I'll be curious to see what happens with, like, the next set of latent titles, since I don't think Nintendo's going to end up publishing them. I mean, that's been a bunch of points for me because I followed the handy feature that we have on the site for how to get the most out of your coins.
Nicely done. Very nicely done.
That's called a smooth plug.
Yep, you are smooth, James.
But I followed the advice on that and got the maximum number of points I could out of Unwound Future, which ended up being more than most Wii games because I pre-registered that I was going to buy it. Then I did the pre-registration survey, which is stupid. Then I bought the game. Then I did the post-registration survey. Then I did the post-play survey. So after I basically told Nintendo everything their marketing department could ever want to know about this game.
It's like, how long did you take to play through it?
There was a question about how much time did you spend playing the game. It didn't ask over how much duration that was spread. I would have given them an outlier answer, I'm sure.
They just would have been totally bemused if you'd been able to tell the truth about that. They wouldn't have known what to do with that information. Do we make the game longer? Do we just get this guy a different social life? How do we fix this?
We need to blow up his DSi right now. Make him buy a new one. Clearly he'll do it.
Yeah. James, do you want to take up the next letter?
Tim from Pennsylvania writes, "Just recently I picked up New Super Mario Bros. Wii again. Last year when it came out, I completed nearly everything in the game, with the exception of a few particularly frustrating star coins in World 9 and the secret exit in that god-awful wind level in World 2. I eventually became bored of the game and didn't play it again until this week. My skills were very rusty and I was not expecting to complete them until I had readjusted to the game. To my surprise, I was able to effortlessly obtain the star coins that had given me trouble before, as well as reach the wind level's secret exit in one try. In the end, it had only taken me about half an hour to complete what was previously an insurmountable challenge. Have any of you had similar experiences where coming back to a game after an extended break has, quote, made you better?"
John, I mean, you've had extended breaks.
But he didn't come back to them. That.
Pac-Man on the Atari 2600? Kill that game now. Kill it.
With God of War, were you better after on PSP?
No, he just didn't finish. It wasn't a matter of being better. He just stopped.
Yeah, you know, that's a very good example, Greg. I see you're definitely keeping on top of my non-gaming. It's pretty impressive.
I have to pay attention to these things.
You do only have one game to refer to. That is very true. But yeah, I would say probably. It probably made me a little bit better. I mean, I was definitely kind of beating my head against the wall with that last boss for a while.
I think that is usually the problem. I just feel like, I've said this before with some really hard stuff like Bittrip Runner. There comes a point where what was a perpetual process of improving your play if you don't get over the hump, it starts to decline.
You do actually regress, yep.
Frustration starts to build up.
Yeah, the frustration, fatigue, whatever it is.
You start to cut corners. Maybe you don't do, like, you know.
Yeah, there's sloppiness. Sloppiness is the enemy. And I think and that's why if you could come back to it fresh at some point, it can make it easier. I mean, James, have you ever encountered this Mr. Layton in 2 days?
So not in that series, but I don't struggle with the puzzles of that series in general. So that's not really fair. So I feel like I've experienced this. Like, I feel like I've talked about this with people
with
before.
With Pokemon Mystery Dungeon?
No. No one could come back and be better at that game because it's just dice rolls.
It implies that there's some sort of...
There's some skill involved, and there isn't. But actually, the best example I have is when I was trying to marathon Galaxy 2 for the sake of the review, where there'd be a level that was just stupid hard. You know, one of the random levels where it's just like suddenly way harder than it needed to be. And I would just throw the control and be like, am I done with this? Ah! And I'd walk away and then come back, you know, 3 hours later and be like, well, that was really easy. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, with the thing with Galaxy as well is that typically, you know, Galaxy 1 or 2, unless you're right down to the nub on the stars, you can just do another star. And that can be your vacation from that one that was giving you the problem, rather than literally putting the game down and coming back to it, you know, like weeks later or whatever, as was in this example.
But my objective there was to do the unlocks in the first pass so I could just have them done when it was time to do the review, just be done with
it. Yeah, I mean, those are sort of special circumstances which certainly lend themselves more to that problem, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, I was also probably had been playing for 4 hours at a time, so mental exhaustion had I had 3 days to beat the game.
I know. It was very diligent of you.
Mental exhaustion had definitely kicked in some of those levels, where it was just like, okay, that platform's moving. And then you're like, wait, no, it's not. That's just my head. That platform's not moving.
TYP, have you got an answer for this one?
Well, certainly it's happened to me in real life with bowling. I feel like the more I bowl, the worse I get at it. I took a class in college, a bowling class in college, one unit, and I swear my average was better before I started than after I finished that class. But in video games, the best example, I can think of two good examples. One is, I think I may have be talked about it before on one of the podcasts, but it's F-Zero GX.
Oh yeah. Well, I had the exact same experience, I think.
Yeah. Except I was on easy mode and I was having trouble, Greg.
Well, I mean, I was with the story mode. Because some of those are really damn
it's masochism.
Hard.
Yeah, I think it was at like I got really stuck at the race that's like in Las Vegas or their equivalent or some race where there's like a bunch of like pits and it's really it's just really nasty, like cars banging off the track and it's really narrow and there's lava and whatever. And I totally just gave up on that. And like 2 years later, I came back and on my second or third try, I made it through. And then it was like a breeze from then on. I don't get it.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who had that experience with that game in the story mode and that stupid level that takes place in the canyon.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
I didn't have trouble with that one.
Yeah, like, I didn't have that particular problem, but I've heard that too.
It's like the third level, and like everybody I talk to is like, I hate that level.
The other game I can think of from younger days was Zelda, the original Zelda, where I got through the entire first quest, but I got stuck... I think I was looking for maybe the sixth dungeon in the second quest, and I just couldn't find it. And so it was one of those things where I'd come back to once a year and say, okay, let's see if I can find it now.
November 8th, time to find that dungeon.
Yeah, I mean, it was literally a let's bomb every freaking flat surface in the game.
The game basically turned into Mylon's Secret Castle. Yeah. I mean, that's what it turned into.
And I eventually found it by that doing that, just that, bombing every single surface possible.
Internet will never make that happen again.
Yeah, exactly. Definitely. It was
or the contrapositive of that statement, that can never happen again because of internet.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I guess that's just like a sheer persistence one rather than ability or anything like that. But
there's a bunch of games like that, though, where, you know, I might stop because I can't figure out what the hell I'm doing, just where to go. But that doesn't happen anymore, which is kind of weird now that I think about it. It's like movies where a big plot point is somebody couldn't communicate with somebody else. It's completely irrelevant now because we all have cell phones.
Oh, there's always some reason why they didn't charge it.
Well, yeah, I know, but
the phone was busy.
There's a lot of old movies where, like from the 80s, where it's like they can't talk to each other because they don't know who the other one is. Where it's like, well, now that's a completely irrelevant plot point.
It's made contrivance a whole new art.
That's right. The cell phones didn't work because of solar flares.
For me, I mean, the GX was a good example for me, definitely. UN Squadron. Back where I played that.
Really?
I played that as a kid, and I got really, really close to the end. Just couldn't get over the hump.
Oh, yeah. It does kind of smack you around at the end.
Yeah, it could not do it. And then it was immediately prior to me importing the N64. And I was going back through old Super Famicom games and playing them just to pass the interminable wait for that system to show up.
Oh, yes.
And I went back to UN Squadron and did it without too much trouble. Now, what you've got to remember is that was like 4 years after I first played it, and the difference in your skill from being like 7 to 11, I mean, it's probably quite real, you know, rather than just not banging your head up against the wall. You probably just are better at games.
Right.
You know, it goes either way when you're a kid. You either have this inhuman dedication to beat something, or you, like, throw your toys out of the pram and have had enough. Yeah. And I think I hit that point.
There's plenty of that. There's plenty of, like,
So that was one. Another one recently was the whole Wariland Shake It thing with the treasures. Like, it was so easy for me to get the last few ones. This is kind of like the Starcoids example in the letter. I found it so easy to get the last few ones. I have no idea why I stopped in the first place. You know, because I was enjoying that. And yet I know there was a period where it's like, oh, I can't find anymore. It's, you know, it's gotten really obscure now. And yet, right. When I came back to it, it's just like, oh, there it is. There's that one. That's just kind of strange. I really can't fully explain that.
Well, you know, sometimes when you're playing these games, you get set in a way of thinking, like a certain, this is the approach I'm going to take. This is, you know, you get stuck in a rut and you may not even realize it. And you almost have to unlearn those bad habits.
I'd say that could well be it. And then the only other one I can think of is, this go back as well, Star Fox for the Super NES. Because that had the three routes, you know, through the game. The final route of which is incredibly difficult, as I remember it. And I didn't really make a full assault on beating that for quite a while after having beaten the other two. Because even the second route is really quite hard. I mean, the original Star Fox is way harder than 64.
Yeah.
Well, it's just hard to figure out what you're doing in that game.
Oh yeah, but I mean, everything about it is difficult. I popped it in the other day and I realized that you don't start with any continues. You have to earn them from scoring and stuff. I mean, it's pretty damn uncompromising, that game. So I think I needed to put some distance between conquering the first two routes and the third one just to be able to muster the will to try. In that case. Okay, well, now we will move on to the next letter. And John, you've got this one.
Okay, Nathan from Toronto. He writes, while listening to episode 137, Carl Castaneda says you guys needed to, quote-unquote, grow the fuck up and leave the site when speaking of the fact that he hadn't touched his Wii at that time in many months. Indeed, there seems to be a bit of, albeit friendly, tension there when you guys bring up your continued appreciation of Nintendo material. Contrast this with episode 7 of Retronauts, which contained a very positive conversation about Nintendo games amidst a group of gamers who clearly love all games from all consoles. In that podcast, the phrase, Zelda changed my life, is uttered, speaking to a lifelong love of said Nintendo franchise. What is it, in your opinions, that has seemingly fractured hardcore gamers? I can see why people who didn't grow up in the NES era may not be able to appreciate the timelessness of some of these classic franchises. But just why is it that there seems to be a certain ambivalence or even disdain by some gamers when it comes to discussing classic franchises?
I do wish to preface our responses to this with a little bit of background. First of all, I don't think Carl said we needed to grow the fuck up and leave the site. He just said when you do, as if it were this inexorable process. John was actually absent for that episode, which is why Carl was with us, but I don't think there's much hope for John growing up at this point. If it was going to happen...
At 150, you'd think by now he would have already...
If it was going to happen, I think it would have happened already. As to the quote from the Retronauts episode, episode 7, obviously that's a very early episode. In fact, it was recorded in 2006, and it was Shane Bettenhausen that said that about Zelda changing his life and stuff, and obviously that was at the very beginning of the Wii era. In subsequent podcasts on Retronauts or What Up Yours over the next few years as the Wii took shape, he had some less complimentary things to say about Nintendo. So I think that's probably worth bearing in mind. But let's have a crack at this whole, fractured hardcore game, a schism.
We've worn this topic before, and it's so... I don't know what the best word for it is. exasperating.
Well, yeah, it's exasperating because there's really no clear... I don't know if there's a clear reason why it's happening. I think it's... I mean, gaming has expanded, but I don't think that it has expanded necessarily in ways that people that have been doing it for a long time really wanted it to expand.
Yeah, it's like, no, this is our thing. You can't do it.
So I'm not sure this is what this letter is really getting at. It's almost like he's saying like people are poo-pooing classic Nintendo franchises, maybe that even are more like how gaming used to be. I think part of the disdain is that Nintendo, being Nintendo, is very stubborn and in some ways does what it wants to do, and in many ways does that.
It always does that.
And that includes kind of sticking to... We talked about this before with Zelda games, where they kind of are doing the same thing over and over again with them. And I think that is part of what pisses off hardcore gamers that have been around a while, is that, you know, they see these other games from other companies on other systems that are doing all these different things that Nintendo just hasn't tried to do, really, at least not internally. And I think some gamers are just fed up with it and can't say, well, that's how it used to be. This game design's outdated.
And other people find, like, you know, clutch that close to their heart and they like it that way.
It's Mario.
I think it goes to what John said, kind of the ownership issue. You know, people feel like they have an ownership of what gaming is to them or whatever. I mean, that's always going to be different. If you grew up in the NES era, you know, which seems to be the question here, you know, people who grew up in the NES or Super NES era, you know, and how they kind of fork off in different directions after that. I mean, some people, you know, might love a band when they were young or films when they were young, and then they don't like them anymore when they grow up, and then other people continue to love them till the day they die. I mean, that's just, I think that's part of it, is that there are certain people will carry certain aspects of gaming with them and discard others. You know, so you could have two people who grew up playing the identical kind of set of games on the NES, but for someone, the things that they carried with them might have been, you know, RPGs, and another person, the thing they carried with them would be, you know, Mega Man and action games and stuff like that. You know, and then once gaming does expand and they can actually sort of service their own sort of more narrow individual taste on a much bigger scale because they've got more companies offering them more experiences in that particular field, then you get to really see how different those two people are. I mean, I think that's goes to the growth point again. You know, because gaming was so much smaller back then, you know, it just kind of bunched everyone together to playing a lot of the same stuff. Mm-hmm. That nowadays you have so much more ability to kind of express your different tastes because the market is so much richer.
And everybody likes to feel special.
Well, yeah, I think part of it is people who have genres of games they like also feel now like, am I going to get somewhat left out? I mean, if you read message boards, which I do because I hate humanity,
you can also read talkback threads on Yahoo News.
Yeah, I mean,
those are always like make
yeah,
your soul
those are always good.
I just like to confirm your cynicism.
Look, it's long since been confirmed, but you'll read these threads and they're like, "I hate casual gaming. It's ruined games." And you're like, "Wow, that is a bold statement that makes no sense."
Well, I think, I mean, that's kind of a split between people who've played games since the old days. There's people who are sort of tolerant of the casual games and all that, and there's people who are intolerant of it. But that's, again, it's a different distinction between, you know, I think the real question is here, you know, why do some people, quote unquote, move on from playing, you know, Mario and Zelda, and they don't do that anymore, and they just play, you know, Call of Duty, whatever else that you want to mention, on GTA, Halo, whatever.
Bro games, right? Is that do you want to go ahead and say it? Bro games.
Other people keep playing the Mario's, Zelda's to this day.
It comes down to image. I mean, some of that comes down to image. And it's been there for a very long time, ever since the whole Sega does and Nintendo don't kind of crap. I mean, there's a portion of the gaming community, just like a portion of the larger political community and everything else, they like controversy. They like taking a firm stand and saying absurd things and not wanting to listen to the other side because, Mario's stupid. It's for kids. I like my PlayStation. You know, it's the same thing. It's just modern.
I don't know. See, the thing is, my take on it is that I think that there's a lot of Nintendo bitterness that goes on, right? Because a lot of what I see, it could be construed as people who really deep down in their little dark hearts, they really wish that Nintendo consoles did have all of the, you know, Modern Warfare games and all of that stuff. But they're bitter at Nintendo because they don't. and they want, and they really want one console that plays every single game that they want, and they know that Nintendo are really the only ones that could provide that. They could potentially have all of these Modern Warfare games if only they had the hardware to run them, right? But then on the other hand, you would also have all of the Mario games that are only ever on Nintendo consoles. So I think there's a big swath of people out there who are angry at Nintendo. Really, deep down, they're Nintendo fans, but they just act like they hate Nintendo.
And so it's a sort of act of rationalization. They sort of dismiss it all out of it. So I don't need to play this game.
Well, I guess that, I mean, I guess everybody knows that Nintendo, they're the best game makers on the planet, and they could make any kind of game that they want.
Miyamoto can make Halo, or a Halo, as I think you put it.
And so that's kind of a gift and a curse, because as much praise as you get for what you make, being Nintendo, they also get cursed for stuff that they don't make, because everybody knows that they could. I think they could. You could argue for it, you know, and say, "Oh, well, they make stuff that's very Japanese or whatever." But
they make. I mean, they make other stuff. I mean,
yeah,
it's been said that, you know, by Miyamoto himself, it doesn't have to be a game I like to be able to go in there and say, "No, no, 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 that's not right."
Yeah,
no,
that needs to be fixed. And it's more perception of being able to understand what your audience wants and how it needs to be delivered.
So the Nintendo doesn't really. I don't know if Nintendo really goes proud of saying, "Well, what does the audience want?"
I don't mean in there as a at a macro level, but within the details of a game, as they're playing, going, "No, no, that's not how that should be. That's not how they're going to enjoy it."
Putting themselves in the players' minds and trying to just sort out what is intuitive and what's really going to allow the players to discover things organically. I mean, that's really how
for example, people are going to play the Wii Remote in their right hand. We should flip the whole game so they don't get disoriented. I mean, no other publisher on Earth would feel like that's necessary.
All right, well, we'll get on to the next letter now. This one is from Chris. He says, "I live in Chicago and just recently had the pleasure of seeing the Video Games Live concert when it came through here. It was a truly multimedia event with trivia, interviews, and discussions between each of the pieces. Of course, the music was the centerpiece, and Video Games Live really did a great job of celebrating this often overlooked aspect of video games. They have over 40 melodies from different games created, but they only play about 15 to 18 in a given concert. The concert I saw included Halo, Castlevania, and an awesome melody for Mega Man, and many others. They also had two performances of solo flute for Zelda and Mario, and they were indeed theatrical and fun to watch. I highly recommend this concert to anyone who loves game music. It is a wonderful celebration of what is definitely an art form. If it comes to your area, check it out." Has anyone here been to TYP? You must have been.
Yes, I went several years ago after GDC. It must have been like 2007. And yes, I agree with everything Chris said, even back then. I mean, it was amazing. And actually, that particular show, Koji Kondo was in town for GDC, so he actually played a little bit. He was feeling under the weather, so he wasn't at his peak. But yeah, I mean, it's a great show. You know, they'll invite people from the audience to come play whatever, Frogger, and there'll be a giant screen. They're playing Frogger, and the orchestra is playing music, and they vary depending on how well they're doing, the player's doing. And there's just some really crazy stuff that they do, and it seems like they do continually add to the repertoire and mix things up. I mean,
yeah, we've been new games coming out all the time.
Absolutely.
Something about they've incorporated stuff from Uncharted 2 now, which is really recent, obviously. So it's always growing and expanding. I mean, I'd love to go. I'm sure it must have been in London at some point.
It goes around the world. If you go to the website, they have a list for like up for the next year of where all they're going around the world. And so wherever you live, you might be able to. You know, you might have to drive a ways, but...
Yeah, I don't think the last time I looked, there's a London date for, you know, this season yet. But I'll have to keep looking. Of course, if you're interested in hearing more about Video Games Live, there was an interview that Johnny did with Tommy Tallarico back in June. So you could look through the RFN archives around that time. It's really interesting interview, plenty about Video Games Live, how they put the show together, what's involved, and just Tommy's involvement in composing video game music and working on the sound design for Metroid Prime and stuff like that. It's just very interesting interview, well worth looking into. And also, there's a new, relatively new DVD and Blu-ray set of Video Games Live that's come out in the States anyway. I don't think you can get it here yet, if ever. I'm not sure how that works with who would release it, but I think it was in the middle of October, Video Games Live Level 2. So I assume that's, you know, incorporating all the sort of new arrangements and stuff, and it's got some bonus materials and things. So that sounds pretty cool. If you can't, you know, if you're in a location where it would be very difficult to go there in person, that could be a nice substitute.
Yeah, and just for Greg's sake, London's listed as a TBA right now.
Right, yeah, I thought so. That's what I remember the last time I saw it. So definitely worth keeping in mind, because I think that'd be a riot, personally.
Well, Greg, if you went to E3...
They play one there, yes.
And they're doing one this year, too. June 8, 2011.
Gotta make that trip across the pond, brother.
Or you could just go to Malaysia, where they're apparently playing in a few months for some reason. I'm not kidding. Two dates.
We go back around now to TYP for the next letter.
A different Chris in Chicago writes, I've heard talk on your podcast, along with others, that gaming in Japan is in a decline, but I haven't heard specifics. What exactly is going on in the Japanese market? From what I've seen of Dragon Quest IX DSLs and other systems and other franchises, it doesn't sound like the market is in trouble. Could you all speak to exactly what's wrong with their market now versus the past? What caused these problems? What do you think Japanese gaming scene needs to do to keep itself from shrinking?
Well, we have probably a month ago or so, we had a kind of a succession of discussions on this topic. I don't think we're really going to get into exactly how to fix the problem, because that's probably beyond our ability and scope to deliver.
The root of the problem is that Japanese just don't like video games anymore.
Well, interesting to keep in mind. But what I did want to speak to directly, just here, we've put some distance between now and those discussions that we had before, is first of all, obviously, when we talk about that, and I think we've been pretty clear about this, but to be clear again, it's the Japanese console market that is really suffering. Mm-hmm. So that clearly excludes DSLs, Dragon Quest IX, whatever craziness 3DS is going to inflict in Japan when that comes out. You know, it is the console market that is really hurting there. And to the issue of specifics, I did a little research into this issue, see if we could get some sort of hard figures. The first thing, for instance, is that globally, Wii sales are trending very closely with those of PS2. I think maybe at one point it was selling at a faster rate than PS2 did, and maybe it's come back to it a bit now because it has slowed down, you know, fairly significantly in recent times. You know, the projections for the next round of sales figures in America are that it's probably going to finish third behind PlayStation 3 and 360, you know, so it's definitely slowed down a bit, but still... At the end of this year, we should have sold somewhere in the region of about 80 million units, globally, that is. And if you look at the same stage in the life cycle of the PS2, it had sold about the same amount, about 81 million. Now, if we look at Japan, how the PS2 did there in its first 4 years on the market, the best I've been able to make it out is that it probably sold somewhere in the high teens by the end of 2004, whereas the Wii, by the end of September this year, had sold under 11 million units. So you could see that's a very significant drop-off there. The most popular console of this generation has sold about two-thirds of the units of the most popular console of the previous generation.
And how does that compare to other consoles in market?
Well, the PS3 has sold somewhere in the region of half that many units, which is more than, say, the GameCube had done back in the previous generation.
But still, collectively, we're dealing with a smaller number.
And I guarantee you the 360 isn't selling.
360 has sold one to a guy.
The 360 has probably sold somewhat more than the original Xbox.
Yeah, oh, yeah, it's definitely more successful than the original Xbox.
But still, it's clear...
It's carved out its own niche there.
Yeah, with shooters. Downloadable, old-school shooters, it seems to be the big thing, but rather than the first-person kind. But clearly, if you're the most popular console... has fallen off, and you know, the PS3 is not nearly popular enough to offset that fall. The console market has shrunk, quite simply. And some of that is because the handheld market has absorbed it. There's a rivalry in a way between the two, and the composition of the Japanese gaming market as a whole has shifted in the portable direction because of things like the decision to put DQ9 on DS, but also some of it is, you know, Japan's cultural stuff. We've been into that before, but that's a specific there. The console market is shrinking. That is a fact. Mm-hmm. And also, this was in an article that's picked up by the BBC website recently. So if you want to see it, you could just go to bbc.co.uk and type in the search Japan plus video games. You'll find it. And it's kind of was following up on Keiji Inafune's comments before he left about how Japan just makes terrible games now and everything's doomed.
Inafune seemed like he was near a nervous breakdown for the last 2 years. And I mean, yeah. Like if you saw him at E3, he didn't look right.
Mm-hmm.
And he has been slagging off what Japan does as a country in the console gaming scene for quite a while. And that you've kind of built to a crescendo after TGS and now he's left the company altogether. But he was focusing on that, but it had a stat in there that certainly caught my eye. They didn't really fully explain what this was based on and precisely what they were referring to. But what it said was that in the early part of the last decade, so I think it was 2002, the estimates were that Japan accounted for 50% of the global gaming market. Today, they account for approximately 10%.
Yow.
We've got to remember a lot of that would be because of the explosive growth in gaming in the West.
Yeah.
Whereas in Japan, the console market's declined, the portable market, you know, it's relatively stagnated. You know, with handhelds winning and consoles losing. But that's kind of stagnation juxtaposed with, you know, nearly a decade of big growth in the West, especially with software. You know, the one of the big software breakout hit franchises of the past so many years, going back to the early part of the last decade, it's Halo, it's GTA, yeah, it's Call of Duty. They are the ones generating a lot of the revenue there. So I guess that's why it's such a decline there. And like I said, I'd take that figure for what it's worth. It was not kind of fully sourced and explained. But it kind of goes to some of the things that, you know, we've talked about before, that basically Japan is, you know, at best running in place.
Well, I think one of the main things that happened was, I think the Xbox 360, even though it's done nothing in Japan, in the West, what it really allowed was it kind of brought the really high quality PC game development to the masses, because it was essentially just PC hardware. And so all of these, you know, Western PC game makers said, hey, well, we can just port our, you know, we can, all these games that we're already making for PC that aren't really selling anymore due to piracy and what have you.
Because they've all been pirated.
Yeah, because of, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, the Xbox 360 was kind of their answer to all of that. And so they brought all of these, you know, their existing high-profile franchises from the PC and also started, you know, they just kept doing what they had always been doing, but all of a sudden they had this really fertile new market on the 360 to actually run with.
So maybe an extension of the 360 success. Would it be reasonable to say that we ended up with a fractured market this time because Sony doesn't have a stranglehold?
Mm-hmm.
Microsoft, I would say, is the edge right now, has the edge in terms of the HD consoles. In terms of,
not just
in terms of numbers, but in terms of driving what developers do. They placate Microsoft before they placate Sony.
I think Japan also, just overall, probably over the last decade, they've dropped the ball on kind of a couple of things. Online play isn't nearly as big over in Japan as it is in the rest of the world. Because, I mean, you look at the games that are really big in Japan right now, you know, Dragon Quest IX, Monster Hunter, those games are not big. I mean, especially Monster Hunter in particular for the PSP, where that game, you know, you play those games, for the most part, you don't play them online at all. But yet they're huge hits, and they're huge, you know, people play them in groups as opposed to playing them online.
Yeah, the ad hoc multiplayer and stuff like that. I mean, it's horses for courses. That's what the Japanese market, you know, is supporting right now. Obviously, Inafune's point is that, you know, maybe Japanese developers need to look, you know, more outside their borders, because, you know, the Japanese market itself is, you know, it's stagnant. It's, you know, it's not a growing population country. It's not really a growing economy. You know, we've said these things before.
Mm-hmm.
There's some fundamental reasons for it, and then there's some discretionary reasons for it in terms of the way developers choose to try and maximize their business model. But I thought it was worth trying to bring what figures we can, at least, to some of these things that we've spoken about before.
I think in general, there are fewer grown-ups that used to play games that are still playing games in Japan. I know Nintendo's specifically trying to target that with things like Brain Age and the like, but I think very much more so than in America, people that grew up playing Final Fantasy games just don't play games anymore. And it's not that they didn't think it's for kids or whatever anymore, just they don't have time. They're not, you know, it's just...
Lifestyle.
It's like, well, okay, that was what I had time to do back in college, but now I just can't do that.
There is the fact that it's one of the fastest markets in the world in terms of its growth in average age too. Mm-hmm. I mean, Japan as a country is getting older at a rate much faster than anywhere else.
Yeah, the birth rates are low. They're very long lived over there. Yeah, and so just
the population is gentrifying.
Those two forces, as they continue to act in the same direction, it's getting older. That is some of the reason why Nintendo has tried to branch out in the directions that it has, is out of necessity, you know, for the Japanese market, but then those things can apply elsewhere, you know, which is how you end up with Helen Mirren doing Wii Fit commercials.
Yes.
I'm sure if Johnny was here, he'd make a Caligula reference at that. But,
and then we would all just groan at him because he's made too many, right?
See, once again, I perform capably as the people who are not here. Now, and I will once again attempt to do that by moving us on to the final letter of the evening, which James has.
Wyatt in New Hampshire writes, "First off, I would like to thank Johnny for recommending the Mad Cat's portable drum kit."
You're welcome. Oh, sorry.
Thanks, Johnny. I have the god-awful original Rock Band drum set, so it made a huge improvement when I duct-taped the Mad Cat's pads and switched out the kick pedal. As for my question, games being remade or ported is nothing new. However, I think that they are occurring more often in recent years than in the past. Examples include God of War Collection, Team Ico Collection, the Sly Cooper Collection, HD versions of Oddworld Stranger's Wrath, and the recently unveiled Beyond Good and Evil HD on XBLA/PSN. Then there are countless ports and remakes for handhelds, including the upcoming Star Fox 3DS, Ocarina of Time 3D. Are you against ports/remakes? Are there any games that you want to see get this treatment, especially for the 3DS? What's your favorite port/remake? And then parenthetically, he notes that Greg's is Zero Mission, obviously.
Yeah, if you want to call that a remake.
Yeah, so I want to qualify this. I'd say there are three categories. Port, which is really more or less a direct port with the same assets. There's remakes, which is basically the same game, but maybe with some updated art, maybe one or two extra things. And then to me, there's a reimagining, which is significantly different, which I'd say Zero Mission falls into the reimagining.
Yeah, it falls into that category, I would say. Yeah. So I think the first thing I want to mention is that a lot of the examples that Wyatt references there could be attributed to the fact that Sony discovered that instead of trying to make a new backwards compatibility solution for the PS3 after they ripped it out, they'd just rather sell a lot of the top
sell
titles
to you again.
It's just, I think that seems to be directly attributable to a lot of those there. There's also, at least in Europe, I'm not sure if this is slated for the States yet, but I think in a week's time, the Prince of Persia trilogy, you know, the Sands of Time trilogy, is coming out on one Blu-ray for the PS3, for instance. So, I mean, I'm certainly not against having, you know, different ways to play this. You know, somebody who plays the virtual console games all the time, you know, I kind of get frustrated at the fact that there are, you know, certain games that, you know, aren't out yet, or they look like they're never going to come out, and, you know, all the frustrations that go along with the virtual console service, even in Japan. You know, I'm all for, you know, having games be as available as possible. Mm-hmm. But I suppose where you kind of draw the line on that is where we do get into the kind of rivalry, where remakes or ports become, especially those two rather than the more substantial reimagining type that TYP broke down, where remakes and ports become such an integral part of a company's structure and strategy that you feel like it really is detracting from what they could be doing with other games. Right. In terms of development resources, in terms of marketing resources, you'd like to see more original stuff. I'm sure there must be some people who feel that way with the way Square Enix does their business. You know, if you look at the DS, you know, especially in Japan, where they have re-released Dragon Quest VI now, so that's 4, 5, and 6 for Dragon Quest, the 3 and 4 for Final Fantasy, Chrono Trigger, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. You know, when it's that kind of, when it accumulates to that level, you start to wonder, well, if you didn't have this sort of wing of your software development dedicated to that, what else could you be making? So maybe that crosses the line, but in general, I'm pretty tolerant of it.
Yeah, I mean, I also, for me, I like it more when, or I appreciate it more when it's a game that I kind of have a hard time getting otherwise, like the Eco collection. You know, I mean, of course I'm interested. The God of War stuff, you know, I'll probably pick it up at some point, but I don't have a burning desire to pick up that collection, even though it's been redone in HD. But the Eco collection, I don't have Eco, so I'd love to get that.
Of course, Radiant Silvergun.
Yeah, exactly.
And port.
Yeah.
I'm amenable to it if like I'm usually pretty happy with it if it's from a console to a portable, because to me that is a big deal. I mean, I certainly, in spite of how contrived it was, I enjoyed some of the Mario Advance releases just because I wanted those games on the go. And then for like Final Fantasy IV, I mean, it was a huge reworking, even though it was a remake. I mean, it was the first time I played it and it was great. I enjoyed it very much. So I don't have a problem with those inherently. But yeah, to me, some of these things like re-releasing Conker's Bad Fur Day or to a lesser extent, things like the Team Eco thing, although I think some of those were underappreciated and maybe that's a good move to
get well, and I suppose it is going to bring, you know, the up-resing and, you know, it's going to run presumably as smoothly as it can possibly run. And they're also adding stereoscopic 3D.
So, okay, I don't care too much about it. It's like, okay, I own a PlayStation 3 that is backwards compatible, so I already bought Eco for my PlayStation 2 for this exact same device. So it seems like it's like too soon, you know?
Well, when there's a pretense of value added, you know, you to get, obviously, as you said, I mean, you know, GBA had so many of these kinds of games, and the value added there was it's on the go, which, I mean, you know, to a lot of people is a real value added.
Yeah.
Perhaps not so much to others, depending on, you know, how their lifestyle is and everything. And it's probably be similar with HD and stuff. You know, some people are kind of really, you know, supremacist about that kind of stuff. Like, oh, it's my eyes, I can't look at it now. Whereas if it's up-res, maybe they're like, oh, yeah, I'm quite happy to go back to this, you know. So it's going to vary by people's, you know, little foibles, I think.
I hate to say this and not sound too cynical, but I wonder how much of this I wonder how much of this is really just all these PS3 ones is really just flushing out a release schedule that they thought had holes in it.
Oh, yeah, I think that's part of it. And like I said, I think they know that there's some sort of demand to play old PS2 games, and this is the conclusion they've come to as to how to, you know, drain money from that. They patented that weird little box attachment that, like, you plugged in this little sort of box that was effectively like a PS2 hardware stripped down, and then you put a PS2 disc in the disc drive of the PS3, and it acted as if it was a PS2, and, you know, they had all these wacky ideas for how they could do this, and it seems like they think, actually, you know, let's give them a little bit of value added with the HD stuff, and then give them titles that are heralded and well thought of
and rare.
I mean, again, rarer the better.
Yeah, there's a lot of ports on the Microsoft download service from Lord knows how many systems now, but it's really become like a graveyard of Sega games and old Xbox games now. I mean, it's like you're walking through a museum when you delve into some of these old games. You're like, oh, look, there's 7 games that no one on Earth ever played unless they live in Japan.
If one of them was Metal Wolf Chaos, I'd be
if one of them was Metal Wolf Chaos, I wouldn't be on this podcast right now because I'd be hunting down Richard. But the strategy they've taken is kind of similar, but it's a little bit less of a shill. They basically went and said, "What games can we get that have a reputation that maybe is more due to their inaccessibility or just plain rarity?"
I mean, scarcity tends to drive up people's interest in certain games sometimes.
It's not dissimilar to what Nintendo did by deciding to release
the original Sin and Punishment
for the N64 on the Virtual Console. They knew that game had kind of a cult following, even though it never came out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and there was some interest surrounding it just because of that, you know, kind of curiosity sort of thing. But I don't think you could quibble with making stuff, you know, officially available to people who didn't have the chance before.
Yeah, I'm not saying there's any issue with that. I'm just saying that's kind of the different strategy that those two companies have employed.
Well, let's move on now to the other part of the question, which was, what are your favourite examples of this? John, have you got one?
Let me think. Ports and remakes.
John would have to have played the original. Chrono Trigger, obviously.
That's his favorite.
It's definitely
that
my
millennial
favorite.
Fair bit never gets older.
Come back to me. Let me think of it for a minute.
All right. James, what about you on this
ports
one?
And remakes. That's tricky because I tend to avoid them. I mean, I guess you could say it's a port, but it's really just kind of a side port. A lot of the Dreamcast games that got ported over to the GameCube, I'm not sure if you want to count those or not.
Yeah, I mean, it was relatively close, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, like Skies of Arcadia on GameCube when it came off of the Dreamcast scrap pile with all the added content. I really enjoyed that title, and despite its almost masochistic tendency to make you fight random battles, yeah. I probably cleared it 3 times, which means I probably spent 500 hours fighting stupid swamp monsters in the air.
TYP?
I think I sort of answered this already, but I think I'm going to give two bundles of answers, one for games that I'd played before, and right. one for kind of a chance to try something out fresh. For remakes that I'd already played, I want to say some of the Mario remakes. So even though it was console to console, I really like Super Mario All-Stars for some reason.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, especially because they're re-releasing it everywhere on a disc now.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I'd buy that one again, but back in the day, it was one cartridge that had all of my favorite Mario games, all my favorite games on there. Yeah. And the new graphics, new sound, and some new levels for the lost levels. So I thought it was really cool. And then the portable ones, especially the original one that started it all, the Mario Brothers DX for the Game Boy
Color. Game Boy Color.
That was a really quality port.
Oh, yeah.
And it kind of set a high bar for subsequent ones, which maybe didn't live up to that in terms of some additional content. They had whatever stuff for the Game Boy printer, some multiplayer racing stuff. It had,
had
extra things to find, like the Yoshi eggs. They even threw in some of the lost levels as a kind of a bonus levels. So it had a lot going for it. It was just really good. And it was the first time it felt like it was like a real use of the color feature. You know, like there were some recolored Game Boy Color games that clearly didn't need color to be playable. Yeah. Mario Brothers felt like, wow, I'm really holding like a console game in my hands finally, you know?
Link's Awakening did similar stuff and added a bunch of content. It made use of color pretty well. It added
the color
printer.
Dungeon, right?
Yeah, it was okay. I liked it more because it was my first time I owned that game.
Right. So,
and for games that I tried for the first time at ports, once again, still in the handheld space, Dragon Quest 1 and 2 for Game Boy Color. I have really fond memories of that. And then Final Fantasy IV, which we already talked about for DS.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely, like, in terms of straight port, Chrono Trigger is a big one for me, actually, because just being portable, it allowed me to see elements of the game that I never would have sat in front of a console to do.
Like the first time you go back in time, John.
What?
Did I just spoil that for you?
Damn it. I didn't know it was about time.
I mean, just being portable, you know, stuff like, you know, the new game plus, getting different endings. It's just, you know, the way I am with games, RPGs, I would not have sat in front of the Super Famicom to do that. Or I wouldn't have sat in front of the Virtual Console to do that, in fact. But, you know, by virtue of, you know, what is a very faithful, well-executed, if, of course, you know, the trivial extra content version, in that sense, I think the on-the-go part was a big deal. And in the reimagining says, yeah, we've covered Zero Mission. I mean, I don't even know whether I really want to say Silent Hill Shattered Memories because it is so
it's
different.
It's not Silent Hill 1.
It's so different. But that is, yeah, really, really cool game. I enjoyed that a lot.
Now, what I'm going to try is GoldenEye for Wii.
I'm not even sure what we'd call that.
I don't know.
A reevaluation of the same source.
It's definitely
material.
Not as like distended as Silent Hill in terms of, you know, because Silent Hill's almost like a different genre.
There is some shot for shot things that are pretty much.
Yeah, but at the same time, it is a different developer, different Bond. You know, it's pretty different.
It's a different Bond, but you only see his face as the camera sweeps around in the exact same way it did in the N64 game for every level. Well, it's from the movie. That didn't happen in the movie. The movie wasn't in first person.
No. Yeah, well, GoldenEye, it sounds pretty cool to me. Johnny will be back next week to talk about that a little, assuming he's had time to play it. But before we wrap up the show, I do want to mention, I remember when we did a show with myself, James, TYP, at the end of last year, James talked about replay through Lufia 2 for the nth time.
Probably the sixth.
Yeah, whatever it was. It's clearly 100. One of James' favourite experiences. And that has been remade for DS. Well, it's been out in Japan for quite a while, hasn't it? But it came out recently in America. But it hasn't been getting very much coverage. But the coverage it's got is really positive.
That's so weird. It's so weird.
It's getting good reviews. And here's the really interesting part to me is that they have significantly changed the gameplay, apparently. It's got like an action RPG now rather than turn-based. And it's, you know, kind of more Zelda-like in terms of puzzles and stuff like this. So
if by that you mean they have block puzzles, yes.
Well, I'd go by reviews. So.
It is more Zelda-like in that they spend more time on having the right item to solve the puzzle to advance in the dungeon than the old game did.
Right. So, I mean, I just kind of wanted to ask you, someone who's clearly played the original in that case, you know, a lot, and cherishes it in a way, you know, how you feel about that kind of, you know, situation, which is very different from the umpteen amounts of the DS RPG ports that we've already seen, where they're actually going to make fundamental changes. I mean, is that something that you don't like, or that, you know, well, even if you don't like it personally, you don't mind them trying it? How do you feel about
it? I'm apathetic towards it. I wish I could get that game on a portable format as I remember it.
Right.
I'm kind of surprised it's been getting good reviews in the US, because I remember it got relatively killed by Famitsu, which is like saying it got 3 points instead of a perfect score. But I didn't really want it to be a Tails game, which is what the combat system basically is.
Right, you're well covered for that as it is.
Yeah, and I don't really think of that series that way, so it doesn't really bother me that they did it. But it doesn't. I'm not super interested. I mean,
so in that case, you'd be more interested in, you know, kind of what I talked about, Chrono Trigger, just, you know, being able to access that experience that you've already had in a new way,
right,
rather than actually have a new experience.
That's more related to it being that game than just my personal preference for games in general.
Like, right.
Like if they did this with, say, this game or Breath of Fire 2. If they did it with Breath of Fire 2, I might kill somebody. because that game is revered for me personally. But, you know, it's just, that's an experience I thought was really well polished, put together. And playing it at E3 was not a good demo.
No, I played it too.
This is the demo where they futz with the leveling, and so you were fighting the last boss or something?
So the demo started with you fighting the last boss, and you both were actually leveled beyond max level. So you were like level 200. And they gave you the very first starting weapons to fight him. And he had the very first starting weapons. So everybody did one damage.
Definitely. Whatever else you may say about the game, it seems from the reviews, which admittedly are scarce, but there are some that are very positive, that they definitely didn't put the game's best foot forward with that particular demo.
Like I said after E3, the Natsume booth was a disaster. I mean,
I know.
It was pretty bad.
We played 5 demos and all of them were in some way broken. It was like, how did you... Oh my god.
Natsume, you have reduced James to a cameo from Final Fight.
That's
a shame. Well, it's going to wrap up Listener Mail for this week, and indeed the show itself, so we'll just get on with the obligatory ending phase without any plugs for the latest episode of Discover Music Project about Shatner's solo stuff or whatever.
You just did it! You're gonna have to.
Or what about Box Office Poison? We're not gonna talk about that either.
I don't know what's going on with that. Obviously, crosstalk.com with a W is the place to go for all those various shows.
So I've heard.
We already talked about my podcast, Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, mm-hmm, with Pedro Hernandez.
If you want to learn how to curse, Radio Trivia, there you go.
Or you've already listened to this show, wow, which I have been decidedly swear-free today.
Always worth checking out Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, excellent video game music podcast. Of course, we thank all the people that wrote in over the past couple of months to create this listener mail segment. If you want your letter read on the air for discussions or question answering and whatnot, send that into rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Of course, we're always happy to have new reviews or ratings on iTunes to help people find the show. And you can hit us up on the Facebook group at facebook.com/RadioFreeNintendo. Usually we have kind of midweek updates and stuff like that, but Johnny kind of does all that, so nothing this week.
Don't worry, guys. Doc Ock will be back next week.
Yes, he will. He'll be back with his many appendages that you will have received.
I didn't know.
Wait, I didn't say anything. No. I didn't say a damn thing.
Going out on a high note. So
going out on the lowest note the show has ever left on.
Mr. 103 says nope. This, so don't forget. Thanks to TYP for joining us.
My pleasure. It's fun to be on.
John, thanks for managing to join us. I hope we could keep this win streak going, as it were.
I'll see what I can do.
And James, it's never the same without you, and we'll never bench you again, especially after the other guy fumbled on like the first play.
Look, I won money on that. That's all I'm gonna say.
What are you, Pete Rose in it over there? Jesus.
I bet against Rex Grossman, yes.
And one last thing. Obviously, last week we revealed the winner of the latest retroactive poll for the DS, which is The World Ends With You, the Square Enix RPG. And so we've all been procuring our copies. Hopefully you've been doing the same and playing through the game. The thread in the forums to discuss it is now open, so you can post your thoughts in there. And we will be discussing the game in full in an episode shortly. So until next time, thanks for listening, and we'll see you back in RFN 220. Bye bye, everybody.
Later.
Bye.
James, do you want to take up the next letter?
No, but I'll do it anyway.
Oh, that's what I expect from you.
It's called manning up. Tim from
Whoa, manning up.
I would have been fine until John snorted.
Man
that was
beams.
It.
Yay.
Okay.
I was thinking more Archie, Eli, Peyton manning up.
That was where I was going with it.
James' forehead just grew.
Oh, it's already big. I mean, it's a big forehead.
Disney Interactive recently held an event at Disneyland to promote Epic Mickey, and DYP was there to grab photos. You too can experience the swank life of a video game journalist. More Inspector pictures included. And to go along with that blog are TYP's impressions, which also have been elaborated on at length in this podcast. But let me read my own copy, damn it. Fresh from the Disneyland event, TYP gives his opinion on the gameplay of Mickey's newest adventure. Is it platforming gold or strictly for fans of the mouse? Read his impressions to find out, or rewind this podcast.
By the way, you already know the answer.
I'd love it if you could just buy VC games with your Nintendo points. That'd be awesome.
Well, you have to exchange them into something, John. I mean, for God's sakes. Look, listen. So, to our listeners, we had this editorial discussion once. We were trying to determine how to denote points. There are three types of points. There are Nintendo points, which can either become Wii points or DSiWare points. All three are not the same, and it's like the Nintendo points transform and can never go back.
Yeah, so if you leave them as Nintendo points for several levels, you can teach them special moves.
Yes, it's like Pokemon. once you use the DSi stone, they turn into DSiWare points. Yes, it's exactly what happens.
So if you read
Nintendo press announcements, because you should, because they're hilarious, oftentimes you'll see all three phrases used at some point in the press release.